Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to a new Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mowell, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there, y'all.
Who is the y'all that you're addressing when you say that?
Oh, the audience.
Is this like a... Do you have anyone specific in mind, or is this just a generic greeting or salutation?
Well, I don't know who's listening. I mean, technically, no one's listening yet. So there can't be any one particular person I'm saying hi to.
Saying hi to a microphone.
Yeah.
And to me.
Yep. All the government agents listening in on our conversations.
Yeah. It's like, hi CIA, hi KGB, hi...
whatever the Chinese...
CCP, I don't know what their division is.
But yeah.
Hi Google, hi Amazon, hi... That's what we should do in our, like, we should have a credits where we, you know, thanks to these people or whatever, and yep. Then just thank all the agencies and organizations listening in every week.
But they can they at least, you know, when they're listening in, can they at least increase our
listening count?
Yeah. That's not fair.
I was just wondering, does the count include their listens, or do those go into like a hidden bucket?
Ooh.
I'm going to guess it's probably the latter.
Yeah.
It's nothing through the front end. It's all querying a database somewhere. We have an interesting non-sequitur to start with here, which is... now I'm going to draw a blank on the question that I was going to ask. It's a statement. It's an idiom.
Yeah.
The idiom, we were just talking about this right before we started recording. The exception proves the rule. And Jack responded in a very strongly oppositional way to that statement. So, Jack, lay out your thoughts and your position on the idiom, the exception proves the rule.
Sure. So I've never been a fan of that phrase, because for something to be a rule, it kind of has to apply universally, unless there are stated exceptions. But then those exceptions themselves are kind of part of the rules. So it kind of, you know, if a rule is that if you are over, you know, the age of 20, then X, Y, and Z, then somebody could say, oh, but I'm 15. I guess I'm the exception to the rule. It's like, no, the rule only applies. Like, it only is stated for 20 years older or more. Like, you're just don't, it's not that the rule doesn't apply to you. It's that you don't meet the requirements of, well, I guess you could say it doesn't meet the requirement of you. You don't meet the requirement of it applying to you, but you're not really the exception. Now, I think we can all agree that something like gravity is sort of a rule of the universe. Two pieces of mass are attracted to each other. Now, if somebody was like, oh yeah, gravity is a law of the universe, it applies to everything. Mass attracts other mass. Well, except for Bob over there. And then the camera pans and you just see a guy floating in the air. Bob's the exception to the rule of gravity. Therefore, Bob's being able to just float effortlessly proves that gravity is a rule. It's like, whoa, no, it doesn't. If there were just random people that gravity didn't apply to, we would seriously have to reconsider our definition or understanding of gravity. So no, the fact that Bob is magically unaffected by gravity does not prove that gravity is a law of nature.
So I made the counterpoint, and I didn't use this example, I'll just extend your analogy. If we find someone named Bob who's floating, and everyone else is still stuck to the nearest large body of mass, I think the point of the idiom, not taken like literally, is that everyone's going to look at Bob and go, wow, he is in some way subverting gravity through means we don't understand. But because the rest of us aren't all floating, we understand that there is a rule which all the rest of us are subject to, that Bob is somehow an exception to. So it's not saying that they're, that the rule is always true. It's saying, because it's so obviously true of most of us and not of this other person, like us observing someone who's in violation of that rule reminds us of how constrained we are by that rule.
Okay. So I, as you were explaining this right before we started recording, I think I'm getting that the point of the idiom is by seeing something that isn't behaving normally, you realize just how regular what you would, the thing that you are considering normal is. So like being affected by gravity, right? If every, you know, every year or two, you see somebody who's able to just float on by, they're not affected by gravity, they can fly up and down as, you know, without any effort, that'll remind you, oh yeah, like I am affected by this thing called gravity pulling me down to the earth. That sucks. And it'll help you remember that, that that the behavior of, in this case, gravity. So if the exception, if the phrase "the exception proves the rule" is meant to say, hey, when there are exceptions, it highlights the thing that you've been taking for granted and have completely forgotten about. And you can now kind of appreciate it a little bit. Like it, you're reminded that, oh yeah, gravity is a thing because I'm seeing somebody who isn't affected by gravity. That's really odd, which then reminds me, oh, that that's just how regular gravity is.
Right.
Because when I see somebody not affected by it, it's weird. But so I can understand that, and I can appreciate that sentiment, but the phrase "the exception proves the rule" is, I think, an overly poor way of putting that. Because if you're playing Monopoly, segueing into the games versus sport topic that we still have to close out, if you're playing Monopoly, and it, you know, what's a rule of Monopoly? I haven't played it in like 20 years. You get, what,
do not pass go, do not collect $200.
Sure. Do not, you know, do not pass go. You know, that rule applies to everybody. That's when you land on a square, right? A specific square.
Yeah, or there's a card in community chest, I think you can get, where it's like go directly to jail.
Well, how about this? Let's use an example I do know. In chess, right? Okay, if you the rule is if your king gets taken out, you lose the game. Well, except for me. If my king gets taken out, I don't lose. In fact, I get another queen back in its place. And then there's no other piece that you can defeat for me to lose. And it's just a matter of how long it takes me to win. See, that proves the rule that the king is, you know, the item that makes you lose or win the game. That doesn't prove the rule. It just means that the rule just randomly doesn't apply to me. In fact, that signifies that it's not a rule in the first place.
See, now I've got to take you to task on the point that you like to make so frequently, which is that we should take statements by their spirit and not by their letter. And I think you're taking this by the letter and not by the spirit.
I think that the wording of the idiom, I think it needs to be reworded, because when I hear "the exception proves the rule," right, I have heard that my whole life, and I've never understood it, because for me, a rule is something that applies universally. Or let me rephrase that. A rule can only be a rule if there aren't random exceptions. And by random exceptions, I mean like the law of gravity is a good example, right? If there were just objects with mass that randomly, or to us, weren't affected by gravity, then we would not be able to, you know, call gravity a law of nature or something. I'm not sure if that's the best way.
So, going back to
the speed limit, right? If the cops were like, yeah, I see that guy speeding, but he's going 90 and 55. He's fine. Goodbye me. And then make you say, well, is it really a law then? I mean, in that sense, it's a technical law that it's written down in the books. But if a law isn't getting isn't getting enforced effectively, can we really call it a law? Like, do I need a treat like one? Can I just go ahead speeding?
Yeah. So going back to your chess analogy, the thought that came to mind is the move en passant. I'm assuming you're familiar.
I am not familiar.
Okay, so for you and for our audience. En passant is a, well, I'll start from the beginning. The rule for the movement of a pawn is that you can only move straight forward. And your first move, you're allowed to move up to two squares from your starting square. But after that, you can only move one square at a time, right? Those are the rules. And it's only straightforward unless you are capturing a piece.
They can only capture pieces diagonally forward, right?
Correct. Yeah, you can only capture pieces diagonally. And they can only capture, they can only capture a piece which occupies that diagonal space in the forward direction, with one exception, which is this move called en passant, which is when two pawns are side by side and one of the pawns is on its opening move was to move to that second square away from its starting space. You can, with your pawn, move behind it diagonally and capture the pawn. So you're not moving onto the space the pawn occupies, but you are moving diagonally to one space immediately behind it. And you can capture the pawn that way. So why did I think of this? Because it's a move that's pretty rare within chess. I mean, it's not excessively rare, but it's fairly rare. And it's not like when you're teaching someone the basics of chess, you're going to teach them pawns can only move forward in a straight line and they can only capture pieces diagonally and they move on to the space that of the piece they capture. You're not going to explain that additional nuance of that special case to the beginner. And so the generic rule for 95% of the moves you'll ever make with a pawn is exactly as I described. But then at some point, somebody will go, oh, you could do this. And you're like, well, I can't do that. That's not how pawns work. And you're like, well, it's an exception that you can do in this exact instance. And so again, it's not, if you just saw that move made, it wouldn't prove the rules of the pawn's other movement capabilities, but its rarity highlights how strict the rules for pawn movement are under normal conditions.
Sure. But I would still say that quote exception is itself a rule.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But I would argue in your example with Bob, there's a rule we don't yet understand or haven't explained as for why Bob is floating. It's not that he's exempt from gravity. It's that there's something else that we don't understand or observe that is either counteracting gravity in some way. It's not that he's exempt from it.
But that gets to the gist of my point, where if you see Bob floating without any rocket packs or magic, or without any like magic tricks or anything, he's just legitimately not affected by gravity. It's an illogical, poor conclusion to say, well, he's just an exception that's proving my understanding of the law of gravity.
But think about what the word exceptional means. Right.
Usually out like outstanding from the norm.
Right.
Yep.
So essentially, I mean, yes, I won't argue that the wording could be better, but it's essentially saying that you could rephrase it by saying exceptionality proves the norm.
I don't like the word prove. Maybe what's the word? It like brings to light or elucidates. Is that the right word? Maybe not.
Highlights. Accentuates, emphasizes.
Yes, thank you. So like the exceptions highlight the norm or emphasizes the norm or something. Then I would 100% agree. But I think that the original wording of the idiom is misleading, and it makes me think that, wait a minute, because this rule doesn't apply in this circumstance, that means that it's a solid, trustworthy rule? That doesn't make any sense. That's how I've always interpreted it. That's why I've never understood it or liked it.
I think most people understand the context of that idiom, in a less formal way. Maybe I'm curious. I mean, if you're listening, we'd love to hear from you. If you have also been confused as Jack was as to why that phrase came to be, or if you've understood from the context in which it was used the way that I explained it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's something else, if we both missed the mark somehow.
Maybe we could make a poll. One other example that popped in my head, and I have to get it off my chest, is like, let's say you're...
Wait, hold on. How did it get from your head to your chest?
You know, like when you have like a sinus, like where you have a head cold and you get all like the sinus mucus and then you swallow like a big loogie. That's how it happened.
Nice. So drainage down the back of your throat.
Yep.
From your sinuses. Excellent. Yep. Okay.
Continue. That's where I store my thoughts, in my sinuses.
This is like a real dark age medical journal discussion right here.
Yes.
Where is the nexus of a man's thought? Probably mucus. And
tubers.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like the phrase, but the exception proves the rule, or I'm the exception that proves the rule, to me is sounding like our manufacturing process is so good. Well, what about that part that came out all mangled and incorrect and out of spec? Well, that just proves how good our manufacturing process is, because it can produce parts that are bad. What are you talking about?
Okay.
That's what the idiom sounds like to me.
Okay, so extend that analogy. If you're thinking about like Six Sigma, right? Like a quality control process. Their measurement of success is failures per million parts or whatever, right? Failures per million, we'll say. So they know inevitably they're going to make a bad part. So the exception, the bad part is coming eventually. The numerator is a guarantee. The denominator, how many good parts do you make per bad part, is the question mark. And so in that sense, the part that comes out mangled and bad from a process is the exception that proves the rule. If every part came out mangled and bad, wow, you've got an awful process. If one in two parts comes out bad, you still got an awful process. But if it's one in 10 million parts come out bad, you wouldn't look at that part and go, wow, you've got a terrible process. You would look at that part and go, wow, this is the first bad part you've made in 10 million. Sounds like you've got an incredible process.
Okay, I get that. What I'm saying is the phrase, the exception proves the rule, implies, at least to me, that the more exceptions you have, the better the rule is.
Well, it says exception, singular, not exceptions.
Sure, but if you say this is the exception that proves the rule, then that means that implies that, well, the rule wasn't proven until we found a case where it doesn't work. Now we know it's true.
Sure. I mean, I think your point is it's the antithesis of empirical science, right? Which is that once you can find a case where a premise or a hypothesis is not true, you've just proven the hypothesis, and then you have to go refactor it.
It's like like in math classes from high school to college, they say when you're doing proofs, usually the goal is to find a counterexample. If you're trying to prove that some hypothesis is, or if you're trying to find out if a hypothesis is true or not, what the general trend or the general practice is you assume it's true, and then you try to play it out and see if you can find a counterexample where, oh, well, if this is true, then this conclusion is what we would get. But that conclusion is obviously false. Therefore, the hypothesis is false. And so it seems to me like the idiom is saying, start with your hypothesis. And once you find an exception, once you find a counterexample where it doesn't work, now you know it's true, which is the exact, as you said, antithesis to how mathematical proofs are actually done.
Well, I was just going to say that mathematical proofs operate in a very different way to some extent than like what we would consider proof in a legal sense or in a scientific sense, right? Because you can write a mathematical proof that we would say is essentially airtight. Like a proof is always true. But within science and within our legal system, we can't prove anything. We can disprove things, right? Okay. So like we can't. So I guess what I'm getting at is the math or science and legal system take a negative approach to proof, which is prove things that are not true. And math is the other way around, essentially, where you're proving things that are true.
Oh, okay.
Also, that just reminded me of this really random engineering thought I had within the last couple days about Newton's laws of motion, since we're talking about exceptions and gravity and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So for the equation force equals mass times acceleration.
Yep.
What if you are applying a force to an object that is not moving or accelerating, isn't your applied force zero?
What do you define as the applied force?
So let's say there's a pallet of dry cement mix on my sidewalk.
Yep.
And I go up to it and I'm like, I'm going to push this over. So I get all squared up and I've got both my hands braced against this pile of cement mix and I'm pushing with all my might, but it's not moving at all.
Mm-hmm.
So from my perspective, I'm applying a force,
mm-hmm.
but from a system perspective, and if you think about it in terms of that equation, there's no acceleration.
Yep.
So force should be zero, right?
The net force is zero, but you can have two independent forces acting on a body that cancel each other out. That doesn't mean that they aren't applying a force. And we can prove that I don't necessarily the idea of proving or something. I really like putting people into scenarios where would you bet money on this hypothesis being true? If I can, you know, design an experiment that would really put it to the test. And here's a test I was going to say. Let's get a cage made out of wood, something not particularly like, and pretty weak wood, like twigs or something, right? And then let's attach two giant rocket engines, one on the right side, one on the left, that would blast off and push inward. Rocket engines are perfectly balanced. So when they go off, there's no net force on the cage, at least in the transverse location or direction, right? So it wouldn't push the cage to the right or to the left. Would you feel comfortable crawling into that cage before I fire the engines? Or would you know that that the cage is going to get crushed because you have two independent forces pushing from the right and from the left?
I'll take the cage. Sounds like fun. It would be exciting regardless of what happened.
That's true. I don't know if you guys can hear Milo yowling in the background, but he's getting his poop crazies right now.
Oh, poop crazies.
Yep. For some reason, when he does his number two, he gets the zoomies and we'll just start running around and caterwauling and then he'll calm down. And I've asked the vets about it. I was a little worried when I first got him. I was like, is there something wrong with him? Is he like, is it painful for him to go? Or is there something wrong with his digestive system? And they checked out the stool sample. They felt him up, you know, inspected him. They said, well, we didn't find anything wrong. So they said this. They said, quote, some cats are just weird. Which is true, but it's like, I want a more scientific diagnosis.
Sounds like a case of the exception proving the rule. circling back, just to close the, put a pin in that palette analogy. So in that example, if you consider me pushing and the palette as a system, the net force is zero. So there is no acceleration. That's what we're, anyone could observe, is that I'm pushing, but the palette's not going anywhere. But that's because my pushing force is being resisted by the weight, actually the normal force generated by the weight and the force of friction of the palette.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a, if you could see the force generation, like imagine the palette as this really chunky dude pushing back against me who's just not budged at all, right? There's still...
Really, it's the floor pushing up. Bulk, so imagine the palette laying on a big bulky dude doing like, you know, like bench pressing this palette.
Yes, yeah, sure. That'll work. So anyway, external or the net effect of the system is no acceleration, no force. It's not going anywhere. But that's because the forces are canceling, which is also, I mean, one of the fundamentals of what we do within engineering is being able to solve for forces and moments based on that assumption.
Moments being the, I don't know why they're called moments, but like twisting or bending or torque, basically.
No, it's just like an instant in time, especially when you're with someone you care about. It's really special. It's a, you just have a moment, you know.
There's a lot of
engineering, and then you calculate those
moments out there.
Forces and moments. Okay. Any other thoughts to add on the whole idiom front or anything else we've talked about so far?
No, this tangent lasted considerably longer than I thought it would, but I'm glad to get off my chest. I apparently had a lot to say about that idiom. A lot of unspoken, unspoken trauma, apparently.
Idioms are certainly a source of, I would say, nearly eternal wonder and discussion. Anyway, with that established, we are now going to return for part two, as promised, of our topic on sports versus games. And in our last discussion, we took a stab at defining what a game is, what a sport is, where they overlap, where they're different. So, Jack, maybe you'd like to kick us off with kind of a recap of your thoughts on what we discussed last time and then maybe build on that foundation.
Sure. So I thought we really only got as far as kind of nailing down what a sport was. And I might need your help to recall some of the points, but one of them was, and these aren't listed in particular order. One, there needs to be some sense of competition. You either need to be playing against other people or something like a clock. So if you're trying to like beat a particular time, that being your goal. Two, there needs to be an agreed set of rules that are being played by. So like you can't have like two teams playing quote basketball and one team saying, well, no, each basket we make counts for 2 points, and the other team saying, well, no, each basket that we make is, you know, 4 points. Oh, and by the way, we don't have to dribble, but you guys do. You know, there needs to be an agreed set of rules and a standard list or standard set of rules that at least the two teams are agreeing upon before they start playing. Point three is the physical aspect, the physicality, where in a good test to determine it can something really be called a sport is if you take the athlete's brain into another body and that abomination it plays the game, is the outcome affected at all? So something like chess, which is wholly mental, or I should say anything that, you know, might involve some physical activity or something like, I'm trying to come up with a good medium example. I guess I'm drawing a blank, but like, you know, is chess a sport? It's like, well, if you take Bobby Fischer's brain and you put it into my body, the fact that it's my hand moving the piece is not going to affect the outcome. Bobby Fischer's brain is what's doing all the work.
Right.
So it's not a sport because there's no physical sense. And then whereas if, basketball, well, right? If you take Michael Jordan's brain and you put it into into my body, Michael Jordan will not be able to do what he could in his own body.
Yeah, I was just going to make the point that, like, to your chess example, Bobby Fischer could tell you where to put the pieces on the board and he would do just as well. So there, even the physical element of moving the pieces, like, isn't impacted or has no impact on the outcome of the activity.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue on.
I think, were those the 3 points? The competition, the rules, and the physicality?
I thought we tied something else in there, but because the game definition was essentially the rules, some objective, right, which could be competitive, it could be collaborative, but not the physicality.
Right. The physicality, yeah, is not a requirement for a game. So that's a distinguishing factor, is the physicality. And the competition seems like that is not a requirement for games. But I would say sports and games both share an objective, right? Like, because how do you determine who wins a sport? Maybe that's sort of tied into the competition thing, like a win or lose, right? Is that a requirement for a game or for a sport?
I wouldn't say necessarily win or lose, because there are some games you can, I guess it's win or lose, but there's, whether you call it an objective, winning or losing, there's a definitive measure of success or failure.
Yeah. Like races are a good example of one that isn't really broken down to winning or losing necessarily. I mean, technically there is somebody who wins the race, the first place, but that doesn't mean like if you're from second to 500th place, you're all losers, right?
You're not first, you're last.
There's that graduation of placements, but it is still gauged on a very hard definition of some metric.
Yeah, that's true. And I also think there's like, especially with something like running, there's, okay, you could call winning or success being first place. You could call it not being first place, but beating your personal best time. You could call it just finishing the race. You could call it, like, there are people who are like, heck, you know, you, like, I started an ultra marathon with my friend Matt Hess in upstate New York in 2013 after woefully inadequate training, and he finished it. I dropped out after, so it was a 50-mile race. I dropped out after 28 miles.
Jeez.
My longest training run had been 10, I think.
Oh my God. Not even close.
So I was averaging like 8 minutes a mile for the first 12 miles, I think. And dang. Then by 15, there was a massive hill in there and I started to feel like garbage. And then it became this like slow jog / walk / rest / stop at aid stations. Which was funny because every time I would stop at an aid station and get some snacks and water or whatever, I was like, I think I'm going to drop out. And they're like, no, this is what you've been training for. And I was like, actually, I have not. But anyway, my point being, yes, I didn't finish the race and I certainly should have trained more. But for me, even getting 28 miles was a win because that's 18 more miles than what I had trained to, you know.
Yeah, that's nuts. That's still over a marathon.
Yes. So technically, I have run an ultra marathon, even though I didn't finish the course of the ultra marathon I was scheduled to run.
I think it'd be more accurate to say that you ran in an ultra marathon. You did not run
wow.
an ultra marathon.
Wow. Wow.
Hey, you didn't, but like running a marathon means that you finish it.
An ultra marathon, though, is any distance beyond a marathon. It could be 27 miles.
Okay.
It could be 40 miles. Yeah, then, it's not a fixed distance.
Then technically you ran an ultra marathon.
I did. Now, you didn't, I just ran my own. It
was yeah, insane. I was going to say you technically didn't run the one that you competed in, but
yeah. Yeah, the event for which I was registered, I did not. Well, I ran in it.
Yeah,
I didn't finish it. But yeah, I think my friend Matt finished, I want to say the cutoff was like 14 hours or something like that, and he finished like 10 minutes before the cutoff, which to his credit, so I bailed out early. His dad and brother were there with us driving a chase car. So I got in the car with them, and then all three of us were like driving alongside him trying to convince him to quit for the rest of the race.
Like, as a means to motivate him, or like, come on, we're bored, man. Let's go.
It was kind of mostly half joking, but we were like, you know, we could go ahead and get a hotel. Like, there's air conditioning in here.
Oh my god. Jeez, that's just cruel.
We were like, we could get a head start on the drive back, you know, it's a long drive. But I think like we were messing with him, but I do think there was an element to which the it was like negative motivation, in the sense that us trying to talk him out of it made him want to do it more.
Right. Dang.
Which I did also, I did a bike race around Minneapolis, around the cities, I guess.
Ooh,
so it was supposed to, the full race course was 400 miles and you had 32 hours to complete it, I think.
Good gravy.
Yeah.
That is stupid crazy. Holy fudge. How do you even do that? Like 32 hours, so like from 32 hours straight, it's not like 32 riding hours.
Correct. Yeah, it's clock hours, not bike hours.
Holy fudge. 32. So if you started like, let's just say 6 a.m., the rest of that day would be 18 hours. So how many hours would you have left?
14,
which means 2 p.m. So 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. the following day, 400 miles?
Yeah, so I think it's actually like a 4 or 5 a.m. start until noon the following day. Yeah, so you got to average 12 and a half miles an hour for 32 hours, or faster for shorter.
And that's not even accounting for rests, sleep, eating.
Correct, yeah.
Wow.
I think most people try to finish like within 24 hours and then go sleep later, but there's nothing saying you couldn't, if you really needed to, stop for an hour and sleep and then keep riding. Mm-hmm. But so I did not finish that race either, but I rode, I think, 252 miles in 18 hours. So I was well on pace to make it. But I only had, so I had a friend from work, Carl, who had agreed to drive my follow car. And I tried recruiting a handful of other people. Nobody else wanted to go or was willing to go.
Yeah.
And so I got at like 11 PM, my Achilles tendon was killing me. Like it felt like it was going to tear off my leg.
Ugh.
And I was like, I need to be done. I'm pretty fatigue, because it was like in end of July or early August, I want to say it had been like 93 degrees that day and like 50-60% humidity, something like that.
That doesn't sound bad. That sounds really dry that time of year.
No, maybe it was higher. I mean, it was super humid.
Yeah,
it was just like dripping, whatever percentage it was. But So I then got bitten by the opposite problem, which was I pulled over by the side of the road and he came up along next to me and I was like, dude, you got to go get a hotel. He's like, yeah, let's do it. So we just bailed out, called in and told him I wasn't going to finish. And anyway, but I'm glad that I did it. Part that I did.
I mean, you still did 250 miles in one go. That's insane. That's like just under double my longest ride on my cross country trip. The longest ride out of all those days I rode was just over half of what you did that day. I mean, I was loaded to bear with gear.
Right.
But still. That's crazy.
Yeah.
What year was that? When did you do that?
That was 2015, I think.
Oh, yeah. That was the year I was doing my bike trip.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, you said that was end of July, early August, so I was just about to hit the ocean. Just a few days away. Cool. Oh, nice. Shoot. That's when I was biking through Maryland. Oh, that sucked. I feel your pain. But I don't understand. They did that bike ride, and then they do Ragbri here in Iowa during the hottest part of the year.
Yeah.
What are they thinking?
It's a good question. I feel like it's masochism or sadism or something. But
yeah, it's poor planning.
They did so the event that I registered for in Minnesota was called like Race Across the Midwest or something, and it was a qualifying event for the Race Across America.
Oh.
Which they do every year the first week of June or second week of June, maybe. And that's from like San Diego to Baltimore, and the winner each year averages like eight and a half days to complete it, something like that.
Jeez.
But they have a full team, you know, like they have a van with spare bikes with food and everything. So their only job is to pedal.
Gotcha.
They got somebody else navigating for them and everything. So
yeah, that would make it a ton easier if you had a support.
But to me, that event is like, yeah, I mean, the Tour de France is the famous bike race that people watch, whatever. But that's like you only ride 3 or 4 hours a day. And granted, I'm not taking anything away from what they do. It's an insane level of athleticism and effort. But it's like 3 to 4 hours a day for 3 weeks versus like 20 plus hours a day for 7, 8, 9, 10 days. That's I can't imagine something more difficult.
A different beast.
Yeah. Anywho, that was a tangent from something you were saying about sports.
Well, I was in this. I can't remember what sparked the tangent. Not yet, anyway. But is our definition? It sounded like the biggest definition or differentiators between a sport and a game were the physicality, and what was the other one? Was it not competition, or was it? Was it that competition is a requirement for sports, but not necessarily for games?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Yeah.
So, are there any examples of, based on our criteria, where that would fall into the sport category, but really should fall into games, or vice versa?
Saying something people think of as a sport that we would not define as a sport?
Definitions would not define it as a sport. Because, you know, a good litmus test for, maybe our definitions aren't that good. If this is considered a sport or if this is only considered a game. What about ping pong?
I mean, there's some athleticism that goes into ping pong. That's
sure.
Well, last time we were talking about motorsports and esports.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I think in my mind, there's no sport in esports. I think that's primarily a game. Now, you could argue maybe on the fringes, but I think given our definitions, it's primarily games. So we should call it e-games or something. Just doesn't sound, I think they just called it esports for marketing purposes, not that they actually thought it was a sport.
And well, they want to treat it like a sport, right? With like the tournaments and the ESPN-esque right. coverage.
ESPN 8, the Ocho.
The Ocho.
Yeah. For which reinforces the marketing point. But yes.
Right. Now, for e-games and motorsports, or e-sports and motorsports, there was the question of the physicality aspect. When you swap brains, does your muscle memory go with you? Because a lot of, like in motorsports, I know they have to have really stupid good reflexes, at least in some motorsports. And then in games, you like or e-sports, you need really good like motor skills and hand-eye coordination. So does that, if that transfers with your brain, then I would say 100% then yeah, then you can put your brain in somebody else's body and do just as well. But if it doesn't, then I think that maybe we have to either reconsider if those things are sports or refine the physicality requirement for sports. Because if we know that motorsports and esports really aren't sports, then our definitions need to reflect that.
Well,
we
I think
we need to come to that conclusion.
What we talked about was that the power source for the activity was your body's own potential energy to be considered a sport.
Yes, that's right.
And that was how that was the way that I got motorsports out of that category.
Oh. But what about, where did we land on skiing? I remember that was, that came up.
Yeah, my argument was that you, the skis aren't providing the power, like your body weight is propelling you down the hill, or what
enabled
you to be propelled down the hill.
But your body didn't provide the potential energy, the ski lift did.
Maybe you hiked up the hill.
Suppose. And but I think that's beside the point. I think
so. We would argue that if you hike a hill and ski down, it's a sport. But if you take the ski lift, it's just a
it's just
diversion.
Oh man, see, that's where we should we need to redefine our definitions. But I would argue that for skiing, and I don't want to, I think we touched on this the last episode. I think for skiing, the effort, the power, and the energy part isn't the going downhill, it's the being able to maneuver your body.
Yeah, right.
Precisely, right. And to get it to go as fast as you can while still retaining control and stuff. In which case, that is provided. That the power involved with the maneuvering is provided by your body.
Which I think for anyone who's remembers their first run down a like a ski hill or mountain in Colorado, where it's just grueling pain in your quads the whole time because it's the most exertion they've had to put out like in your entire life. I think that's proof of how much physicality is involved in skiing.
Yep.
So I think, I don't know. I feel like we've got pretty good definitions for both categories. And I also did, we were talking about it a little bit earlier. I did come up with the term for the combination of game and sport. So we have these two definitions that separate game and sport, but we also said that there's some overlap. And so there's this higher level category that we would also call games, like, you know, game of football or baseball, even though they're sports, they're still in this broader category of game. I am now going to propose that we rename that category GORT. G-O-R-T. And so we could just casually throw out there to a friend like, hey, you want to do some GORT? And then, you know, that leaves it open for whether you want to play baseball or play chess.
Oh, man. Do you want to go? Is it play GORT or play GORTS? Because you don't really usually say you want to go play some sport.
Unless you're like British or something.
Yeah. You normally say, like, I play sports.
Yeah, you do. That's true. I feel like Gort just, it has a more, so much more blunt.
Yeah. Gort
catches the attention. Let's go do some Gort.
It sounds like a really like bad like mushroom drug. Gort.
Or like why can't I think of his name? Mrs. Doubtfire, Patch Adams, comedian.
Trying to blank. Oh, the
Mork and Mindy.
Yeah,
routine.
Mork? Yeah, is it Mork?
Yeah, Mork and Mindy.
Yeah.
Why can't I think of his name? I'm seeing his face in my head right now.
Oh, it's not
Mork. Robin Williams. No.
Oh, the actor.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you were talking about the character.
No. The irony is, I've never actually heard his original bit. I've only seen Steve Carell's version of it as Michael Scott in The Office.
Fun stuff.
So anything else to add to the topic of sports or games?
I was going to say, can we recap our conclusions real quick? So sports was, for somebody to sport, there has to be a sense of competition, you versus other players or player or against something like a clock. Two, the physicality aspect, your trained body needs to have an outcome on the game. If you swap your brain out and to put into somebody else's body, if the outcome is not affected, then it's not a sport. Standardized rules that all players agree to. And I think that's it, right? For sports. And then games, and I would say another thing is sports, they need to have like an objective. But games also share that requirement.
One thing I was going to say for sports too is that I think I mentioned this early on, and you could call this part of the rules or the objective, but it's not universally true, but a characteristic of many sports is that they involve a ball, a puck, a shuttlecock, whatever. There's some object that the participants interact with and use to interact with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Which I would say is a shared trait with games as well.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that a sport requires that object.
Sure, medium, no.
But it is certainly correct. Help in this case. Because we've already established, I think, that racing is a sport, and that obviously doesn't involve some sort of external object.
Except for relays.
Right. But maybe they just, you know, rather than pass a baton, they just high-five each other. Sure. Tag, you're in.
That was like the old, I don't know if you ever did Awana growing up or anything like that, but they had relay races. And I'm trying to remember, I don't think we had batons. I think you had to like tag the next person. I think it was just like that.
Talk about budget cuts, am I right?
Yeah, those expensive batons, I'll get you every time.
Yeah. Okay, so those four things, competition, standardized rules, the physicality, and having some objective, so at least you know what to go for and how to when it ends. And then games also share the objective. They don't have physicality. What were some of the others?
Well, I mean, we talked about, scoring by either like points or time was with a sport, but typically with a game, it's some kind of points.
I was going to say that applies to the rules thing, but
sure. Yeah.
That's a subcategory of the rule requirement.
I think the point I was going to make is that I think the only characteristic that we've talked about, which is different between them, is that sports are primarily physical, or their dominant trait is the physical nature of it, whereas games are primarily intellectual. But I think the other attributes were common.
Competition, I would say, is common in games, but I don't think it's a requirement.
Yeah, I mean, there's... I feel like a spectrum of competition and collaboration in both sports and games.
Yeah, but I would say it's a requirement for sports. It's not a requirement for games. So that is a differentiating factor. A sense of competition is not required for games.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, to your point, there is always an opponent in a sport.
Even if the opponent's a clock.
Well, didn't we decide that if you're just running time trials by yourself, it's not a sport?
Did we? Oh, shoot, I can't remember.
Because it has to have, like, standardized rules and things like that. Like, I think to be a sport, there have to be multiple participants.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about, like, if you're going out and, like, playing catch by yourself, you're not playing baseball. You're just playing catch. You're entertaining yourself, but it's not baseball.
Sure.
You're using a baseball and a glove.
Ooh. Another example that might help us get through some of these nuances. What about, like, competitive weightlifting? Because you're never, like, you know, bench pressing against somebody else to see who wins. And I mean, like, literally against, like, two guys are pushing the same bar in the opposite direction and seeing who beats the other. Right. One guy will do his bench, and then the other guy will go up to his bench and do his lifts, and then they'll compare their results.
Yeah.
So that involves multiple people. It is a sense of competition. Definitely shares the physicality aspect.
Yeah, I don't think that competing simultaneously is a requirement of sport.
What about of Gort?
What about of Gort?
Is there a requirement for Gort?
I think the requirement for Gort is, like, have fun.
If you're having fun, you're having Gort.
There might be some other things that fall into a different part of the Venn diagram outside of Gort.
Gort.
It's fun.
Collaborative. It's Gort.
If you're having fun and there are other people having fun with you and there are some rules involved, it's probably Gort.
Not the catchiest of catchphrases, but
hey, we're a new emerging industry here, so yes. we're gonna have to figure it out as we go.
That's right.
The world of Gort. We're gonna start our own television network. You could tune in for, like, competitive basket weaving at 2 o'clock, and then American Gladiator at 7:30.
Ooh, we're gonna be facing off against ESPN 8 The Ocho.
I hope so.
What about squirrel water ski racing?
That might be difficult to find competitors, but I'm game. Speaking of, as I was walking into the company today, since we have recently been encouraged to return to the office space,
encouraged.
Coerced?
Yeah, there you go. Coerced is a great word.
I was walking up the sidewalk and there was a squirrel, like, scrounging in the planter, or, like, the plant bed where there were some flower bulbs and mulch, like, I don't know, 2 feet, 3 feet away from me, just doing his thing, not a care in the world. So I could ask tomorrow if I see him if he wants to do some water skiing.
Okay. Yeah, do it.
Or she. I don't know. Could be.
What do you tell which squirrel's a dude and which one's a chick?
I think the same way you tell if any mammal is a dude or a chick.
I mean, is their coin purse, like, obvious enough? I guess if you got close enough to inspect it, probably.
It's yes. It's all about proximity, I believe.
There we go. Where are we at it for time? Like, do we have time to get into another topic, or is
we are? We have just rounded the 1 hour mark, I believe. So,
wow,
we've actually been running fairly long for a while in the 115 to 130 range. But I feel like if we get to another topic, it's probably gonna run beyond that. So this might be a good jumping off point for today.
Yeah, probably.
I do just want to mention we've got some interesting topics in our queue that we are excited to talk about. We had a listener suggested topic from Facebook, so thanks Randy for that suggestion. It actually crossed my mind, and I was glad you spoke up, so we'll include that in the future. And then I have a topic. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, because Randy brought it up, and you know, he said, "Oh, you know, thanks for bringing it up. We'll cover it." I wanted to cover it like as soon as we could, like today. And the only reason why we didn't was because we had a follow up on the sport versus game conversation. I didn't want to push that off and for another session, and then kind of really forget what we were.
Actually, I think that topic would be short enough. We could do it if you want to.
Oh, are you okay with going closer?
Yeah.
Okay. And I bothered to bring that up because this point about why we didn't talk about it today, although it sounds like we might, because I want to encourage people that if you suggest a topic and we pick it up, like, you don't have to wait for it to get covered. Right. I want to give you instant gratification. That way, you know, it's just like the American food industry, just give them sugar and makes them feel good. And then who cares if they feel sick later and get all fat? All they know is that when they put it in their mouth, it tastes good. That's going to keep them coming back.
Tangential banter. Put us in your ears. It sounds good.
There you go. Perfect. Print it. Let's go.
On the other side of the t-shirt, Gort. It's instant pleasure.
Sounds so dirty.
That was how you said it, right? No. Instant gratification? Well, I can't remember. Anyway.
Instant gratification.
Yeah.
Put it in your mouth. It tastes good.
Nope. So anyway, that brings us to the topic which was suggested. So it's actually another, not an idiom necessarily, but a common phrase.
Old wives' tale.
Yeah, old wives' tale is a good way to say it. Which, or urban myth, legend, whatever. Which is that hats cause baldness. I'm sure you've heard people say it. I've heard people say it. And there's this perception that if you wear a hat, I think primarily because of like the friction between the hat and your scalp, like wears away the hair follicles over time or something like that. So anyway, I had posted on Facebook that I believe the opposite is actually true, and that there is a correlation between hats and baldness. Yes, but it's that as people start to go bald, they feel self-conscious and start to wear hats more often. So the commonplace observation of seeing someone who is lacking hair wearing a hat, they didn't lose their hair because of the hat. They got the hat because they lost their hair. That's my premise, which was confirmed by at least one member of our audience.
Oh, really? I didn't see that. And I would say I've known some, you know, folks who have gone bald in my life. And I think that the pattern that you observed is holds in my case, too, where they didn't really start wearing their hats until they were already losing their hair.
Yeah. And I would also say, again, it's anecdotal evidence. This isn't some study, but I've known people who wore hats religiously from like middle school and have a funny thick head of hair. You know what I mean? So it's not like there's this direct relationship between wearing a hat and then all your hair disappearing.
Right. I mean, maybe it's, you know, maybe like it, chronic hat wearers, 10% of them would lose their hair, whereas otherwise they wouldn't have. You know, maybe so. Maybe it does have some effect.
Sure.
But and then it, maybe it's like it's enough where people notice a pattern, but not enough where, you wouldn't be able to point out counterexamples easily.
Well, and how would you point out counterexamples? Because it's also certainly true that among the population, I'll just say of men who wear hats, there's a percentage of them who have a genetic predisposition to go bald.
Yep.
So, and you're never going to know, like, if they wore their hat, would they, or if they didn't wear a hat, would they not go bald? Right? Like, you'd have to do a really wacky design of experiments where you set up people who are predispositioned to go bald to wear hats and some to not wear hats. And then people who are not predispositioned genetically to go bald to wear hats and not wear hats, and then compare all the results.
Ooh, I wonder though, maybe you could take like a big, and I think you need a big enough population for the genetic stuff to kind of just average out across any population in your subjects, but you split them off into groups and you have each group wear hats, you know, at different frequencies. So group A, you never wear hats ever. Never put anything on top of your head. Group B, every 10 days you wear a hat all day long, but only every 10 days. And then you kind of keep graduating, like, okay, you're every 2 out of every 10 days, 3 out of every 10 days, so on and so forth. And then you see, is there any pattern? Is baldness more prevalent? / does it kick in faster with hat usage or not? Maybe that's a way of doing it. Because you're now not testing do they become bald. You're more testing when do they become bald, if at all, and trying to correlate that with frequency of hat usage.
Yeah, and that's the other piece is that your hair thins over time with age, no matter how good your genetics are, to some degree or another. So age causes baldness as well. And I think that's the hard part for somebody who thinks hats cause baldness. It's like if you see somebody who wears a hat a lot and then they eventually get bald, it's like, well, it must be because they wore a hat. Like, well, they also could have just been genetically predispositioned to it and they were going to go bald anyway. Or it could just be they're a normal person who likes to wear hats and they started to lose their hair because they got old. But your experimental design would be able to isolate that. So you would, if you studied for long enough, mm-hmm. be able to separate out, you know, like when people were going bald and if it was a result of age or genetics or whatever.
Right. Because if you were to map like the age, at the average age of this group that went, you know, when they went bald, and if you were to plot that against which group they were in, if you saw a, you know, oh, look at that, the groups, the as you plot, like, you know, this group wore hats 0%, 10%, 20%, the further up you go, the younger the average age of when they went bald goes, maybe there is a correlation. But if there is no correlation, then it would just look like a scatter plot, random, there's no pattern.
Which proves the rule.
Yes. There's no pattern to hat usage to baldness, and therefore, that's the exception that proves the rule. Wearing hats causes baldness. Done and done. Science.
Ipso facto. Side note, in case anyone was wondering, if I start losing my hair, I'm shaving my head completely.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about that before we started recording, right?
Were we?
Was it your brother who said, or somebody you know, that they were losing their hair, so then they just shaved it all and then got a tattoo on the top of their head that made it look like they just had buzzed hair?
I do not remember that conversation at all. It certainly wasn't today if we did have that conversation.
Whoa. Are you sure? Who was they talking to?
Yes. Then? I don't know who you were talking to. Was it your little Gort hallucinogenic mushroom earlier?
who the heck was it? Because I was literally thinking, like, just a few minutes ago, just thinking about this conversation. I was like, wait, when did I have that conversation? Why is it so, oh, you know, wait, it might have been, I think it was earlier today at work, because I brought up in a meeting that we have this podcast and that this topic was probably going to come up tonight. And then we got, me and these other coworkers got talking about this. I think it was one of those other coworkers that said they knew some, it was like their brother-in-law started going bald. So he shaved all of his head and then just got a, he got a tattoo artist to, you know, basically just do a bunch of little specks on top of his head. That makes it look like he just has buzzed hair with a normal hairline.
Nope, not doing that.
And I was like, good on him, because he's just owning it. Well, he's not fully owning it, because he's trying to make
it. He's not fully owning it.
But he's still owning it to some degree. He's not like, he's not like trying to make what little hair he has left work. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. That to me is like just a different way of doing a comb over.
It looks better than a comb-over, I would think.
It's like the less effort version of a comb-over. I don't know. I've seen some of those hair tattoos, and I've never seen one that looked realistic. Not in person, but pictures of them.
Yeah. Well, comb-overs are the worst. Can we agree on that? It's like, doing nobody any favors.
Correct. Honestly, even the guys who just, like, they're completely bald on top, and they have it just kind of cut short on the sides. It's like, It doesn't look bad. I don't know. I don't understand quite what the aversion is to baldness.
I'm sure if you saw yourself with like a full head of hair and then you eventually see yourself with that weird monk's side hair, you know, style going, where it looks like you just have like a exposed dome on top of your head, which if you kind of think about it, the head of your shape kind of looks like in another part of the male anatomy, it'd probably be a little off-putting. You know, you're used to, you've seen yourself with a full head of hair, then you see this, you know, weird shape of your head. Now if you just knew that guy and that's the shape of his head that you've always known him, you wouldn't really necessarily think anything of it. But that guy has seen himself back before, you know, when he looked better. So now what he sees in the mirror is, you know, it's a degradation.
Yeah, I don't know, it's just so universal, it's like, who cares? But I don't know. I guess you could say the same thing about me just shaving off the remainder. It's like, why shave it off? Just leave it.
No, not necessarily. Because if you think it, like, I agree that when it's kind of like half gone, it looks bad. It's really hard to make it look good. So it's like, just shave it and then work with that. That's a lot easier.
Right.
To look
good. I do agree. I think it, from the part of our psyche that yearns for completeness or balance or symmetry, whatever, that either a full head of hair or completely shaved is, it's not unsettling either way. Mm-hmm. Right. And I feel like that's what people like, the comb over is trying to pretend to have a full head of hair. It's just like, just shave it. We all know it's not actually.
Who are you trying to fool?
Yeah.
Well,
so anyway,
I think that's a good, I wish we could have covered this fan suggested topic a little more than just tacking it on the end. But at the same time, I am glad we were able to get it in to the session immediately after it was suggested rather than making him wait. Yeah, Randy, let us know. Do you approve of how we cover your topic?
I was also going to say, I don't really have that much more to say about it. I feel like it's, I don't know, it's a pretty self-explanatory thing, I thought.
Yeah, but this is tangential banter. We're supposed to ramble on for 50 minutes on this topic that really should take us no more than 5.
Yeah, that's true. As a closing point to that thought, though, now that you've been informed, you need to go educate the world that baldness causes hats.
Yes, not hat wearage. Or hat. Dude. Hat wearage?
Sure, hat wearage.
Hat wearage. Not that it causes hat wearage. It causes hats. So if you go bald, you will start to see hats appearing in your house.
It's like Bartholomew Cubbins.
I don't know that reference.
No? Dr. Seuss book? The 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins?
Oh, I am not familiar with that story.
I can't remember how he gets this curse or whatever, but the premise is there's this like youth, this young boy who lives in a village, like a medieval village, and some king or lord comes to town and everyone's like supposed to remove their cap to pay homage to this prolific figure. And he takes his hat off, but then another one sprouts up in its place. And then this king takes offense because he thinks it's like some practical joke to mock his rule and authority or whatever. And so he imprisons Bartholomew and it tells him he's going to basically have him executed unless he takes his hat off. And so he keeps taking hats off and keeps taking hats off, like while he's imprisoned overnight or whatever. And he finally is like basically headed to the gallows, the executioner's block. And like right before, it's like any last words, and he pulls the hat and it's the 500th hat. And then there's no more hats on his head after that. Like he finally gets the last one.
Nice.
So, what I was going to say though, is I feel like we've really had some good, catchy phrases in this episode, stuff that we need to start a merch store with hats that say hat wearage and, shirts that say, want to play some Gort.
What was the other one? There was another one in there about like
tangential banter. Put it in your ears.
Yeah, it sounds good. It sounds good.
The other one was something like Gort. It's instant gratification or something like that.
Oh yeah, I'll have to go back and listen. I can't exactly remember.
Be sure to let us know what your favorite phrases were so we can get those on the first batch of whatever we aren't making right now.
Yep. Heck, it took us, like 2 or 3 years to finally get the podcast going. It'll probably take 3 to 4 years to get the merch line going at this point.
Unless some enterprising listener wants to start it, and then we can just license the phrases and tangential banter and, you know, you could sell it and pay us royalties.
Ooh, yes.
It's a win-win. We don't have to do work and we get money. But you do too. I can't imagine a better situation than that.
Everybody wins.
It's a win-win-win. All right, I think we have reached the perfect conclusion for our discussions on this episode. I was also going to tease another future topic, which is a pseudoscience theory that I came up with in high school called the theory of organic gravity. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, and then I'll also describe some of the additions that I've made to it over the years. So we'll be talking about that in the future, and I think we've got some others in the backlog that are still going to be pretty interesting too. So stay tuned for those. And as always, if you want to submit a topic or join the podcast, feel free to fill out the form in the episode description. And till next time, keep your stick on the ice, as they say, and take care.